Cheers, queers. Woo! Thank you all so much for joining us today, and thank you to the Boston Book Festival for having us and to our amazing event producers. It's such an honor to be here and an honor to be with my fellow authors, all of whom I call friend. So I want to start by introducing them and start with my left. We have Milo Todd. Feel free to raise your hand, do a little whatever you want to do. Milo Todd is a novelist who specializes in queer, trans, and poverty topics. He's represented by Esmond Harmsworth of Avitas Creative. He's an alum of Grub Street's Novel Incubator Program, where he worked as a Petchett Fellow on The Falcon of Doves, a work of historical fiction about a trans pirate and his surrogate sea daddy. You want to read it. Next, we have David Valdez Greenwood. His plays have been staged coast to coast, most recently including the National New Play Network Rolling World premiere of The Mermaid Hour. A former Boston Globe magazine columnist and a Huffington Post blogger, he's the author of four books, including Homo Domesticus, the first memoir of same-sex marriage in the U.S., the Today Show pick A Little Fruitcake, and his latest, The Revengers, a YA novel. A Cuban-American, David's work focuses predominantly on LGBT and POC lives. Yay. Next, we have Alexandra Marzano-Lesnovich, the author of The Fact of a Body, a murder and a memoir, recipient of the 2018 Lambda Literary Award for Lesbian Memoir and the 2018 Chautauqua Prize. Named one of the best books of the year by multiple outlets, it was shortlisted for the CWA Gold Dagger and a finalist for a New England Book Award and Goodreads Choice Award. A National Endowment for the Arts and McDowell Fellow, Alex lives in Portland, Maine, and is an assistant professor of English at Bowdoin College. And last but certainly not least for us, Sarah Farazan is an Iranian-American young adult author giving voice to Iranian and queer characters. Her debut, If You Could Be Mine, is about two girls living in Tehran, whose love is both forbidden and dangerous. The book won two Triangle Awards and a Lambda Literary Award. Her next novel was Tell Me Again How I Crush Should Feel, about a girl navigating both her identity as the only Iranian-American girl at her private academy, and also her crush on the new girl. She holds an MFA in creative writing from Lesley University. Sarah's latest book is Here to Stay, about a young athlete, Bijan Mejadi, and the way that a photoshopped image of him as a terrorist impacts his life. Please join me in welcoming them with a big round of applause. Awesome. I forgot to mention, I am Kelly J. Ford.
Yeah, yeah.
There you go. Woo! I will be your moderator today. I use she, her pronouns, and I want to give you a quick note that book sales and signings will be in the Gordon Room on the first floor, so please make sure you do that. Head out there. And then shall we begin?
Sure.
So I've been thinking about this topic of queering the canon for a while, because when I shopped my manuscript with agents and editors, a lot of them want to see similar books. Like, tell me a book that's similar to yours so I can sell it to for sales and marketing reasons, so business reasons, obviously. There was nothing out there like I was doing because I wrote my novel Cottonmouse is about a woman who is queer in Arkansas, but it's also crime, so Southern crime. So I didn't really have anything to compare it to, and it didn't really fit into the lesbian fiction category because allegedly it's too dark and depressing. So I kind of had to say, okay, this book and this book, if they made out, that would be my book. It worked. So, and the other day my editor tweeted that someone had submitted a book to her. It's a queer Southern author writing Southern crime, and they used my book as a comp, which was awesome. Woo-hoo. So if you thought this was all tragedy and doom and gloom because it's queer lives, you're wrong. It's not. But it brings me to the question for our authors. So because the status quo of many of the genres we're working in are straight and cisgender, the authors on this panel are, by definition, queering the canon just by putting their works out into the world, whether it's with their characters or themselves. So I wanted to start by asking our authors, what is the state of queerness in your respective genres? Is it doom and gloom, or is it happy fun times wow? And maybe start by also reminding people of what genre you're working in. And Dave, this might take a while, so just, you know, do what you want to do there. And whoever wants to go, feel free.
I think in young adult, it's a little bit of both. But young adult, I'm so impressed because when my first book came out, it was 2013, and there were books before, but there's so many more books now. There's still a long way to go. But, like, one of the big, you know, blockbuster movies this year was Love, Simon. And one of the rom-com books that just came out this week are by Becky Albertalli and Adam Silvera, What If It's Us, that will have, like, a huge following. And so that's really amazing to see, is that it's, like, a rom-com that's two, you know, cis dudes that are... And there are just so many more authors and stories that it doesn't always have to be, like, a well of loneliness, sad thing.
So sad.
I am encouraged in YA too is that we're seeing more queer people of color, so that, because when I came out there was not a lot, like my books were described as intersectional, which I then I learned what that meant. I was like, oh, I'm both of those things, you know. I can be both, you know. So I choose to write in a young person's voice, I think, because young people are always sort of asking why, and they're always questioning, how can I make my community better? Who am I? How can I speak up for my friends? Whereas the older we get as adults, there's still that want and desire there, but you get more in the muck and mire of, like, how am I paying my rent, and I got book club on Tuesday, and, you know, things of that nature. So I've always enjoyed writing in a young voice because, and I think of leaps and bounds, like, you know, from just 10 years ago, how the LGBTQIA community has moved forward, and there's still a lot of work to do. But it's, I just think that has a lot to do with young people and young people speaking out for themselves and their communities, and the adults in their lives being like, okay, we're learning and we're getting there. So that's been really encouraging. And I look forward to more titles. Yeah.
Great. In my case, when I first started talking to publishers about this book, and I'm writing in memoir and true crime, I'm using a really fractured structure in nonfiction because I'm interested in nonfiction that uses structure to just kind of do something new and make a statement about storytelling and about the multiplicity of stories. And when I started talking to publishers about it, what I got told repeatedly was, why the heck would you put that you're queer in this book? There is already, the book is about the 1992 Louisiana murder, so there's already a pedophile in this, and there's already dead kids. And who exactly do you think is going to read this book? And what I eventually realized, and I should say that it wasn't just publishers, it was also, you know, my first agent was very out as a lesbian, and I got told this by her, too, constantly. I can't sell this book if you put in that you're queer. Which is a bit of a conundrum because it was a memoir. And I think it was code for what I have encountered repeatedly, which is, how do you expect straight readers to identify with this character? We're supposed to go on a journey through your life, and we're supposed to go on those moments with you. And I can't identify as a straight person, as I would be told, to a queer character. And something shifted, because that was in 2011, 2012. My book was published in 2017. I sold it in 2015. My entire publishing team is out as queer at a major, you know, at Macmillan, at the Flatiron imprint. And I did not only did I not get any resistance at all, we didn't get any resistance internationally, and all of a sudden it became a marketing tool. Which is great. I'm not arguing with that. And it tracks a change that's happened in publishing, really, where certainly when I was working at a bookstore in college, it was default. If you got a queer memoir that came in, it was always published by a small press. Small press are fabulous, but it was always published by a small press, and it got shelved in gay and lesbian studies. It didn't even get shelved with all the other memoirs, right? And now what's happening instead is that last year was the first year that there were three memoirs out by female-bodied, let's say queer people, who were not writing strictly about coming out, and or in sort of marketed in a mainstream way. Three is not a lot, but man, three is great. Three is a great start. And I find that I still get a lot of pushback on the queer content, and God knows what they're going to make of the next book, because that's super fucking queer. But I still get a lot of pushback on it from book clubs. And yet what it actually leads to is a really interesting conversation within the book club. Is it weird to show up to a book club and have them, no kidding, spend the first 15 minutes discussing the fact that I cut my hair since the book came out and discussing what that means, like I'm not even in the room? Yeah, but it leads to a certain amount of conversation about identity and about signifiers of identity and about how identity is constructed for the people in the room. And isn't that what literature is supposed to do? Make you question what it is that you identify with and what characters you can see yourself in?
Yes. I've been fortunate that I've been able to work in a number of modes. So I'm a playwright, but I have some nonfiction books and one fiction book. The nonfiction, when I wrote the first book, I was asked to write the book because I was writing a column about same-sex marriage at the time. And so I wrote a book called Homo Domesticus, which at the time was the first memoir of legal same-sex marriage in the U.S. And at the time it came out, the publisher was super into the idea, really loving, embracing. There were definitely questions about, like, how much information is too much, for your average reader, the mythic average reader. But when the book came out, the thing that was surprising to me was, as I did interviews for it, radio shows and talk shows, the number of times people very, like, happily said, well, it reminds me of a normal marriage. You know, I actually had a radio host who was, like, I'm sure he felt like the most progressive person he knew, ask me if I was the wife. Okay, there are no wives at home. We don't have one.
But send them my way.
Yes. What was interesting was, so I wrote a couple more books. I have a daughter. And when she was about 10, I started pitching the idea of writing a book about, parenting and about, adventures in parenting. And by that point, every agent I talked to was like, what's to say? What's new? Like, it seemed just in the shift from, the first book about same-sex marriage, because it was still new-ish, to that moment in a short window of time, it was like, yeah, right? And that's kind of great. That's actually progress. It wasn't great for me because I'm like, well, I don't have another idea. In young adult, I'm new to young adult. I just have one young adult novel. And what was interesting was the discussion with a publisher. The characters in Revengers, it's a genre, right? It's a young adult horror novel, so it's not about a coming out story or anything like that. And two of the characters are kids of color, and one is gay, the leads. And the discussion with the publisher was, the publisher asked me, do you want to kill off this character? Because at one point when I was talking about whether it's going to be one book or three books, I was talking about, killing off one of my characters. And the publisher asked, do you really want to do this? And I thought, oh, here we go. It's going to be one of those things where, oh, you owe it a happy ending. He has to have a happy ending because, there's the dead gaze trope that was so common in so many things. And so I was all prepared to answer, you know what? This is a horror story. If I kill him off, he gets to be just like everyone else, right? It's a horror. But no, the question was, do we want, how long do we get to keep him? Because could we do three books instead of one? And that was a whole new thing to me that suggested, again, a different way of seeing and change. As a playwright, I've never had any difficulty getting gay ideas or queer ideas on the stage comparatively, and I've had a lot of plays with gay protagonists or gay characters. But it's in the last couple of years, as trans and non-binary characters have shown up in the world of my plays, that's been the real challenge, as theaters have tried to duck out of it. Would it be okay just to have a cisgender gay guy playing a trans 12-year-old girl? The answer is no. Right. And I was really fortunate this spring that four theaters that were doing one particular play all committed to it, and they dug down, they dug deep, and they produced actual youth, queer, non-binary, trans youth, in every case, which was terrific. And then they still, on the non-binary adults, two of them caved and went with just gay guys, one of whom was a drag queen, and drag is terrific, but it's not the same thing. So that's the one thing where I'm discovering now that there's still, you know, that there's, the learning curve is eternal.
Well, thank you for advocating also for that, though, Dave, as far as making sure that trans people are actually represented in theater and everything, because I'm sure we're all aware of certain situations recently where they just keep trying to get cis people to take on the trans actors or the trans roles. But anyway.
Scarlett Johansson.
Yeah. I wasn't going to name names, but you went there. Yeah. So what I tend to do is, because I work particularly with trans historical fiction, I like to keep this place of almost like this bittersweet resilience, because essentially, as I've dug into trans history, a lot of it has been cis-washed or completely erased. We have survived, you know, quite honestly, genocide after genocide after genocide after genocide for thousands of years, and yet, you know, it's 2018, and I'm here sitting in this chair. So, you know, cis people, they have bad game when it comes to genocide. So I like to keep that, because I... And there's no wrong way to do a queer story in my mind. If you are that identity and you're writing about that identity, it is already authentic and real, and I encourage people to write whatever kind of ending or theme or mood that you want in your book, because that does celebrate and show the rest of the world the complexity and the beauty of the queer community at large. So nobody ever feel like you have to be silenced because you need it happy or sad or what have you. But I stick with bittersweet resilience, because I never, growing up, I had it kind of tough and didn't like when people would sit me down and be like, it gets better. And I'm like, that, thank you, but unless you give me money and food and shelter and a family, move along. But I also don't want it super depressing and give people no hope, because again, trans people are still here. You know, as we like to call them, our transcestors. We may not be... together by blood necessarily, but I feel we are connected by something even stronger, which is this resilience. Kind of bouncing off what Alex had said earlier about finding someone to take your books seriously and take them on, I have an agent as of February. We're about to go out on submission in a few weeks. You know, yay, hopefully someone buys it. But I was actively trying, as a trans author about authentic trans stories, to... get an agent for over 10 years. And during that time, I had been rejected, I think, somewhere in the vicinity between 350 and 400 times. And the majority of those responses were maddening and very disheartening, because what they would say was, this is a great book. I love it. I could see this being a bestseller. And I'm like, wow. And then their next paragraph would be, but I'm not going to take it, because... And these are my words, but essentially what they were getting across was, publishing is a business. No one is going to buy your book because people think trans people are gross. No one's going to pick it up. I'm sorry, it's a great book, but I need to make money. And so that was very disheartening, because I had nothing to work off of with that. It wasn't, oh, the plot could be stickier, or oh, the characters aren't quite doing it for me, or even... you know, this book just isn't quite my taste or what we're looking for right now, which would have been a fine enough cop-out of an excuse. I don't know why they didn't do that more.
Right.
Save me from this, please. It was just, the bottom line was, it's a great book, but no thank you, because oppression, good luck with that. And I was like, you guys are the gatekeepers, like someone please. So kind of like what Alex had been saying, just in the past couple of years, it's been this massive shift where I've become trendy, and I'm playing that card hard. Hard. So there was, I sent my book off to an agent who wanted to look at it, and he was like this like big deal agent, you know. I sent it to him. 3 weeks later, I get a phone call in February, and he goes, I want to grab you before someone else does.
Oh, great.
Yeah. So, yeah. So He believes in the book, which is phenomenal. So even if somehow publishers still say no, it's really cool to see someone who's that much in the know is like, you're so worth the risk. And that feels really good after 10 years of no. So.
Yeah.
Awesome. Thank you all for that. So my next question, I'm going to lead into this. So the best and most diverse panel I've attended recently was at a crime conference, and it was Southern crime. I was stoked. That's my genre. I was not on that panel. They put me on the queer panel, which was also awesome, but I want my cake and glitter too, right? I want both. So in a way, it feels like there's a double-edged sword when you're a queer author, because it's you get stuck on queer panels. And I say this as someone who brought them all together under a queer panel.
leave now.
But I'm wondering, is there still value in these panels as I look across the room? I'm like, yeah. Is there a value in still having these panels or integrating more into our genres? Is this... are we othering ourselves? Mm. Or is this kind of like our version of a tea dance with books?
I always think... Alex, your jacket's nicer. You go.
We all wore jackets today, so you know we were in a team.
We are sweating for you.
Yes.
Yeah.
Or like the queer sharks, you know, or like pink ladies or some jacket gang. Anyway.
Okay. Just wait till you see the walk as we exit.
Yes, yeah.
We're going to do something. We haven't figured it out yet. two things. Both.
Yeah.
Because aren't we othering ourselves, but also this is community. Yes. And this is hearing that there are other voices and feeling bolstered by the presence of other people who need your story, who need your voice, who need characters who, you know, represent. We have been asked for so many years, and I think we are damn good at it, to relate to straight characters. We've been reading mainstream art this whole time. So we know that we can do that. Great. Now let's make the straight people do it.
Mm. Yeah.
And I think that requires two things. That requires participating in sort of panels that are not specifically queer-themed and putting our stories and our characters right alongside others. But it also requires showing that we fill a room when we do talk about queer lit and queering the canon.
I was going to say, for a lot of my promotional stuff, which I'm very happy to do, I get put on a lot of, like, diverse panels, which is also great, so that can be anything. But I feel like the panelists and I really enjoy when someone just asks us about craft, like a writing question, rather than like, so, how was that experience for you, right? Which I also am happy to answer, and I think it should pave the way. These events are, yes, they're promotional, but they're also to let you know that you can do it too. Like, I know that sounds very like NBC, the more you know kind of thing. But it is like, because I would sit in the audience of these things and be like, maybe I could try it, right? So that's sort of another great thing about it. I will say that I had the great fortune of, in 2015, to go to Australia for a writers' conference. And sometimes people don't know what to do with me when they hear about my books. They're like, oh, okay, sure, you know, like, all right. And there was this moment where I went on school visits in Brisbane with another young adult author there named Will Kostakis. And the first school visit we did was a Catholic boys' school. And the librarian pulled us aside and was like, oh, thank you so much for coming. And, you know, and they were like, but can you not talk about to me the gay content in your book, because we have some parents who their kids, you know, can you not do that? And so I'm in Brisbane. I'm still jet lagged. I don't know how to do my talk because my first two books were about lesbians primarily and other queer characters. So I was like, okay, let's talk about cultural assumptions, but just like fumbled through that for a long time. But then the rest of the school tour was great, and we met a lot of kids who were excited about America. They're like, what's Kanye West like? And I was like, I don't know. you know, but,
He's
and then there was a, there were some Aboriginal students who were like excited to see me because I had black hair, and they were like, come to our student union, and so that was great. But then Will was on that tour with me, and Will is a wonderful young adult author, and he's so good at school visits. He like engages with the kids, and he knows what to say. And I'm always a little uncomfortable with being up for public consumption because I don't know how people will react to me for things I can't control. But Will, a year later, came out of the closet because of that whole, I mean, it wasn't because of that, but he attributed it to our visits together, and that was sort of a catalyst of being like, yeah, I should. Mm-hmm. So I cried about that. So it's also, it's when you are doing events that are also not queer, or you don't know who in the audience is going through something, or who might need your book or your art. I think that's been really rewarding too, is like knowing that there is a panel like this where we can all meet and commune, and everyone knows why we're here. You know, it's not like a, you know, like, okay, that's too much winking. But but that it's nice that we can talk about this openly, you know? Like, it's unbelievable to me. And I know that's crazy because it's 2018, but, like, you think about when you grew up and also cultural context. And, like, my first book ended up becoming, like, a coming out party for me, for my parents' friends. So that was really interesting. They're like, that's fine. Where's the kebab, you know? Where I'd always worried about it for a long, long time. So, but I think both are great. I do think we'll get to the point when you're just a mainstream book and you're just asked to go on a romance panel or on a action adventure panel or on a, and there is more of that happening. I get invited to more kind of broader panels. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I do think the visibility at large is important to me, and not saying that anyone ever has to be more blatant about their queerness or anything, but especially because there are still so few trans authors out there, especially that they're like openly trans and everything. It feels a little bit like I'm going to take that little extra bit of sacrifice and be like, yes, you can do it too. And of course, this is assuming I get a book deal, so maybe I'm, you know, jinxing myself. But yeah, I just, the visibility in characters and everything, it's more than just gay and lesbian studies, you know, getting shelved in that category. But it is also its own little special piece. Because usually if you pick up something that is literary or historical or YA or whatever, and it's also queer, you kind of pick it up knowing you're going to get a little something extra special in that. So I kind of like knowing that when I pick it up because I get really excited.
Because my work is varied across a lot of different topics, I have found pretty much, you know, since I started writing myself gay dropping where necessary, so that even if my play doesn't have a gay theme or a book doesn't have a gay theme, I'll reference my ex-husband, right? Like, I used that language before it was legal even just to prick some ears, right? I still do that. I went to a Comic-Con thing for the young adult novel last year, and I'd never been to one, and I was in costume, and everybody was in costume, and that was great. And people were there to talk about, like, you know, what were the rules of the spell that was, you know, that the kids were up against. And that was great. That was terrific. And I still tried to gay whenever I could, just to have it out there. And just as a reminder, you know, even integrated, we are here. We are queer. We are fabulous. And so that's, you know, that's just, and I think it's really still important too. We, you know, obviously we live in this moment where there are more rights. I saw a lot of really lovely National Coming Out Day posts the other day, and still I felt compelled to remind my community, but the larger community, that, hey, we only have civil rights in 22 states, mm-hmm. right? That's not the majority, just mentioning mm-hmm. it, right? And that, you know, people still suffer terribly mm-hmm. Upon being outed, depending on their context. And so I really do just, you know, I gay bomb whenever I can. If you got hit with glitter, that was...
I was going to say it was glitter. Yeah. Yeah.
So speaking of suffering terribly...
Oh, dear.
That's the transition there. Gotta go now.
Are you ready? So we've all seen, I'm sure, tragedy is associated with queer characters. And commonly when written by those outside of our community. But for some of us, regardless of our genre, fiction, nonfiction, as Alex writes... Happily Ever After is just not our jam. So at the Crime Writer Conference, someone had asked me what characters I want to see more of, and I said serial killers. The great gay gasp, and I had to explain myself. But there, there is a burden of providing a happily ever after and happy light fare at times, and it might be across a different audience than what I write in. But for our community, because we have such a long history of violence and erasure, I'm wondering, for those of you who might have dark souls like me, how do you reconcile that as a writer and a reader? Go for it.
I wrote a book in which, in the memoir half of the book, I was writing about sexual abuse in part. I was writing about a lot of things, but I was writing about having grown up and abused. And I got notes in when I was working on the drafts and I was showing them to friends. I got notes from fellow queer writers that gently said, "Me too. And I'm worried that if you write it, people will think that that's why you turned out to be queer. Mm-hmm. So are you sure you want to write that?" And I will say that gave me pause because I was worried that if I wrote that, other people would think that too. I get asked that by I don't mean to keep picking on straight people, but I get asked this by straight people all the time. I get asked this by interviewers. Do you think that's why? I get asked that in 2018. And so I did feel a certain amount of concern about writing that. And yet, at the same time, if you know the stats, 40 to 60% of queer-identified people were sexually abused as children. And that's just those that answer yes in surveys. So it seems like there is this need for representation says sometimes, yes, sometimes we grow up being the odd one out. Sometimes we grow up being targeted. Sometimes we grow up with these things happening. Sometimes these things happen to us when we're adults, too. And isn't it important to tell those stories, too? The way I thought about it was, I feel responsibility to be honest in the story. I feel responsibility that means to write it in a complicated way, which means that the story isn't just one of trauma, it's also the happy moments, right? It's also both. Any life has both. Mm-hmm. And I think we're all in this community intimately acquainted with the idea that any life has both, that any life has moments of hurt and pain and also happiness and joy and acceptance. Every life has both. And yet we live in a culture in which the constant pressure, I think, is to pretend that the story is simple, is to pretend that every story is simple. So in some ways, I feel like part of the task is teaching complexity.
I can't follow that, Alex.
Yeah, we're done.
I can't follow that. That was good. I told myself on this tour, because in past tours this has happened, I'm not going to vomit and I'm not going to cry, but you made the second thing almost close. So, I think with my first two books, I wrote them in a graduate school vacuum, and I didn't think that anyone would see them. And then people saw them. And so with my work, this last book novel, the main character is a cisgendered straight kid. It took me a long time because there was an audience now, right? So you're sort of like, and I've felt a lot of not feeling ready to write because I don't want to get it wrong. And I had to give myself permission that I can't be the only, like there are other books and other writers who are emerging and are established who are of a similar background. So that I have to tell myself that this is just one voice and one kid and one story. And all my books have been different in that they deal with similar themes, but my first book was really about a human rights issue from a different country's perspective, and I also worry that I don't want people that to be the only book that people read about Iran or the only book that has queer characters in it, because it's not 100% great. I mean, it's the story of my heart, and it had a lot of research, and it sacrificed quite a bit for me. But I also want them to then read other books by other authors who share a similar. It was hard when it felt like you were the only one in the village, mm-hmm. you know, like that feeling of like, oh, I'm the only one. And what's great about the books is that I've met so many other people who have similar stories and have similar things. I always try and have a hopeful ending, even though my first book, it's, you know, I don't want to spoil it, but it's not looking great for her Sahar and Nasreen. They're not going to really go off into the sunset given their situation. But it did always have a hopeful, like, there will be life beyond this romance, or there will be life beyond this. And I think, too, because a lot of the books and movies that I saw growing up where you were excited to see a lesbian character, like Lost and Delirious, you're like, oh, Piper Perabo, good for her. You know, she's going to get with Jessica Paré, and they're making out. What's going on in that dorm room? You know, and then Piper kills herself at the end. So you're like, what? I was there. It was in Canada. I was there with you. I don't know, something about Canada, they're more polite. So I was like, this is nice. And then, but then she died at the end. But then years later, she was in Imagine Me and You, where it is the happily ever after. So to Alex's point, I think there can be both. But I think there has been there's still a lot of people all over the world who are dealing with a lot of stuff that we will never realize. We can relate to, but we'll never fully realize that experience. And those experiences should be shared and be like, this is what it's like here. But there's also humor and light in life, and there are happily ever after stories, which I think there's more of a push for. And for my stuff, I've always used humor in my personal life, if you can tell, and in my work to kind of be a sort of balm to whatever the wound is. Like, it's sort of I want the audience to stay with me, so I give them some bits of joy and humor and heart so that they stay through it, because if it's just dark all the time. And there are books that do it great and effectively and are wonderful, but for me personally, I've always used humor in all of my stuff.
The notion of masking your own experience for, you know, or not masking it, you know, for consumption, you know, really did play into me when I started writing. You could put like probably two panelists together to get to my age.
That's not true.
I'm the oldest person in the room. But I mean, when I started, you know, submitting plays and writing, you know, for the Globe and the Phoenix. This was back in the '90s, and things were still pretty fraught about what your representation might do. So I just did not write about a really signature event of my life, which was that when I was 15. I had known I was gay since I was six. I was a fundamentalist and loved my church, loved God, loved everybody. I was a big lover of things. A visiting pastor came to our church and preached a sermon about how the real moral of the story of Sodom and Gomorrah was not just that God punished the gays, but that God smote everyone around them for allowing them to be. And one of the takeaways, an exact line, was gays bring destruction on everyone around them. My mother was suicidal. My brother was, at the time, I shouldn't be saying this, a drug dealer. You know, we were dirt poor. My father, who didn't live with us, was an alcoholic. And I remember sitting there just being like, it's true. It's true. And I walked directly from that church to the bridge in my town that people jumped off to kill themselves. And there were these arches. And I got to the center arch, and I stood on that arch, and I was praying for forgiveness for what I was about to do, even though I was doing it for God because I was so awful. And I was getting ready to jump off the bridge when a neighbor saw me, and she's like, David, you come down from there. You're going to break your neck. Right? And the thing is, I couldn't kill myself in front of her. And with my mother, I'd had the experience of finding somebody in a suicide attempt. So I knew that. I knew morally I could not do that. And I sagged. I remember being like, oh, I have to live. And so down I came. And she saved my life, right? And here I am. But I didn't write about it, including through two memoirs, right? Years later, many years later, you know, I'm an adult, I've got the books out, and I got an email from a kid in Alaska who was gay and had read one of my books, I don't remember which, and he said, you know, his parents were about to throw him out, and he just wanted me to know that reading my books had just given him some hope, had given him some courage. So I was emailing back and forth, and, you know, he got hooked up with, like, a local organization. They found him a place to live, but he kept in touch. And at one point, I said to him, because he was having, you know, self-harm thoughts, and I said to him, look, I've been there. I've stood on that bridge. I've gotten ready to jump off. It's like, why didn't you say so? It's like, you literally wrote a book about your life up until 18 that doesn't mention it. And I was like, crap, it's so true. And I didn't, because in the 90s, I was super hyper aware of, don't talk about gay kids killing themselves because that's a trope, that's a stereotype, right? Everything ends in suicide. So I didn't want to do that. I didn't want to put that out there. And I wasn't even thinking about the fact that it's true that it happens, and I'm proof that you can survive it, that you can be on the other side. And it really took until, you know, like the last 10 years for me to understand I have to tell those stories too. It's not just, you know, you meet, I'm a pretty happy person. I'm like the jazz hands person. People need to know that, like, you know, behind jazz hands are tough years.
Mm-hmm. I'm glad you're here.
Oh, thank you. Oh, me too. Nice.
Yeah, I've got absolutely nothing to add to that. these guys killed it. And I just kind of agree 100%. And yeah. Sorry.
We answered that question very
really
thoroughly.
Did. Yes. You really did.
Well, I was going to say things, and then I was like, crap, crap, crap.
Well, I'll, like, you take
my
this next
start
one
the next
first.
Oh, great.
No pressure.
I mean, if
no,
you want
no pressure.
To. Okay. So what's your least favorite trope or stereotype?
Good, something negative. I'm good
and,
at this.
And in lieu of that, what do you want to see?
Was what my least favorite trope is?
Least favorite trope and what you want to see. I mean, you don't have to go first, Milo. I won't.
Someone else going to take it first. I wasn't ready for this question.
I don't like that the world doesn't really like women that much in general. so when
problem.
You write, like, lesbian fiction, it's like, oh, that's great. We appreciate you. That's so nice. But where are the boys? Let's, right. You know, and I think also straight romance and that kind of thing. But, yeah, I don't know. I mean, there's so many tropes that I think people are getting away from tropes, at least in YA. I think there's something to be where we are taking fairy tales and making them other, or where we're taking back traditional stories and making them other. Like Anna Marie McLemore, who she's here today, and she has great YA books, and she takes fairy tales and she makes them queer and beautiful and uses a lot of surrealism and I don't know, I just think there are authors who are taking the tropes that they're like they loved, or they were like not cool with how it worked out. Like, I like Beauty and the Beast, you know, but there's part of it, like the Jean Cocteau version, the 1987 Linda Hamilton TV version, which is great, where you're like, are they gonna get together, is that possible, like what's happening. But there is something about that original story that's very, you know, it's basically like Stockholm Syndrome. Like, he kidnaps her and, you know, and that's not great, right?
Yeah.
So I try and see the tropes of stories that I like, but that usually the woman is made to really kind of be saved, or that she's not in charge of her own agency. And so I like seeing stories that invert that and make that different.
I thought of one.
Thank
you, Sarah. I don't like the. I think my least favorite stereotype in trans writing is when people write about, or they expect when they pick up the book to read about something that's very heavy in body dysphoria, which might sound a little weird because you think that is what the trans identity is, but it's so much more than that, and it becomes so focused on this, like, you know, oh, I hate my period. Oh, we're going to talk about this for like 100 pages. Like, no one ever really talks about or makes a distinction between what is physical dysphoria and what is social dysphoria. And the social dysphoria, it seems for a lot of people, is actually where the physical dysphoria comes from. So someone might want top surgery, not because when they're, you know, fooling around with someone that they're very self-conscious because that person's being so accepting of them and are like, I see you as a man or what have you. But when they go out in the world, they have to cover up because they're being harassed and because of all this. So there is this, because this also isn't talked about enough, and I feel sometimes some trans fiction that's not written by trans authors can perpetuate this trope where it becomes harder and harder, I see, for kids, particularly trans kids, to parse out why they want hormones or surgery. Is it because they really need it for themselves, or are they doing it for everybody else? Mm. And, you know, these are major surgeries and major body changes, and I think, you know, we owe it for trans people to... you know, let them decide if it's something they need just for themselves. Because having major surgery for someone else, or like basically just strangers out in the world, not even someone close to you, I don't know if that makes it better or worse, but it's just, it's kind of ridiculous. So I kind of wish that would go away and either discuss more about how the society is implicated in this dysphoria instead of this thing just being, it just happens because born in the wrong body, which by the way is by and large actually an incorrect narrative, which blows people's minds when I tell them that, but we can't get into the history right now.
Great.
It isn't a queer trope that came to mind first for me. It's that I wish that more Latinx people and other people of color were foregrounded as the heroes, not the sidekicks. Mm-hmm. And, you know, that if you had a squad of five people, you could have four people of color and a white sidekick, right? You know, these setups. But also just some nuance and complexity about what Latinx looks like, who can be Latinx. There's a theater in Chicago. I won't name them. Their whole mission is that they're lefty and progressive. And I had a show whose four characters were... a white trans woman, her African-American lesbian partner, their mixed-race son, and a Cuban-American boyfriend. And they sent me the cast list with three white people first. Three out of four of the roles had been cast. And I was shocked. And then when they got to casting the Cuban-American, they called me because they're like, we just, you know, we don't know how to find Latino people because, you know, it's Chicago, it's so small. We, you know, and they're like, you know, but somebody who really wanted the role came in and he was great, but, you know, he's black, he looks black, no one's going to buy that as a Latino. And I was like, okay, so we had to have a little talk. I'm like, so Latinx is an ethnicity, not a race. Cuba is a country. Cuban Americans are people of two worlds. But if you look at Cuba and you look at the culture at all... it is very ethnically diverse and racially diverse, right? I'm like, if you had a Latino who was black who came to you to play this role, call him back. They were too late. So then somebody else came in who was of Asian descent, and they're like, oh, he was really great for the part, and, you know, somewhere in his family, like, you know, there are Latinos, but, you know, he's really visibly Asian. And I'm like, I just said, I'm going to, this may sound familiar to you. And I literally repeated my words for them, right? So I would love for, you know, people to see that people of color exist and that people of color, that of color covers a lot of things. But one way to start is not making four out of five of every set white.
This is less of a trope in the writing and more of a trope in how the writing is read. But... so let me preface this by saying I identify as genderqueer, grew up female assigned, right, like many people, and I have noticed that when I am on a panel, not this one, thank you, and or when I am giving a talk or whatever, and I am presenting with straight cis men who wrote nonfiction books, they are treated as subject matter experts, and I am asked about my feelings. Mm. Yeah. I am always asked, and not to like interrupt anything, but like I'm a Harvard-trained lawyer who wrote a book that relies on 30,000 pages of court records that I spent 10 years tracking down. Mm. I thought a little bit about research. And yet, when I show up at something, I am always asked to do this. Mm. I am always asked, tell me something intimate you didn't put in a book. Mm. I am asked, this and this and this happened, but can you walk us through the, what exactly happened? How were you touched? I mic'd up on a stage in Australia, 3,000 people in the audience, being interviewed by the head of events for the British Public Library, who I'm sure is a lovely guy in other contexts. He established that the book partially concerned sexual abuse by my grandfather. He established that the book concerned this murder. He established that I spent years reinvestigating this murder. Next question, fully mic'd. So what exactly did your grandfather do?
Oh, my God.
And in that moment, right, you're sort of in shock, but you also want to say, what the fuck are you doing? And do I respond to this as myself? Who can suck it up and duck the question? And I'm a lawyer, I know how to redirect. Or do I respond on behalf also of like the people in the audience who have been through similar things and just got the message, as I heard from them afterwards, that it's okay to ask that kind of question, but also that's all that you want to know about them. That's all that they have in their head. So long rant. I've spent a year and a half now being asked these questions. Mm-hmm. And I would love to see us treat people who aren't straight, cis, white men as experts in their field.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Yes. All right. We have time for a couple questions, so I think we have a mic, or maybe you'll yell. Oh, we do have a mic. Oh, thank you. Any questions? Oh, we have one up here.
Thank you, everyone. Hi. I hope I don't stammer through this. Oh. I probably will. What are some queer books that made you feel whole, like, when you read them?
Oh,
like,
yeah.
For me, it was, like, The Line of Beauty, even though it's overwritten, but so yeah.
I when I was a teenager, I knew that I was gay from a very early age. I just didn't have the word for it. But as a teen, I was like, yeah, this crush on your classmate, that's what that is, you know. So I was like, I gotta read up on something. But I didn't go to my school library to look for books. I went to my town library because I felt that was a bit more anonymous, like I could go and find the books I needed to find. Annie on My Mind by Nancy Garden, May She Rest in Peace, was a big book for when I was a teen because I found it very privately and had that experience, and she spoke to it. I got to meet her in 2013, which was really incredible, and she signed the copy of a book I had purchased from like that time period, and had read my first book and said that was, you know, so that was a very full circle moment of like very strange, surreal. I don't know. My mom loves like The Secret, you know, that sort of like, you know, that kind of like self-help, like The Secret, if you visualize it, it will happen. But it was one of those kind of like moments where you're like, oh my goodness, like that was really amazing. And also a lot of the books I read when I was younger were primarily written by women authors, especially who are not white. So I read a lot of Alice Walker. I read a lot of Zora Neale Hurston. I read a lot of Gloria Naylor. So I think there was stuff that spoke to me in their work. And then as I got older, I got to find more Persian authors, and I got to find more Middle Eastern authors. And then, so that was great too, is that, you know, I remember as a kid, like in any like movie credits, you know, you'd see someone's name who was like Middle Eastern or something. You were like, oh, okay. Yeah. Him. All right. Good job, Key Grip or whatever. Yeah. And, so I think it was always trying to find that in every media thing, like looking for parts of you that you didn't always see. Yeah.
Everything had such, you know, when I was younger, you know, everything queer had such bad endings, like they were. Like, so I remember reading Morris or Maurice. There were big debates at my college about how that should be pronounced. And being thrilled because this message came through at the end of the person who doesn't accept it has fucked up, right? And it was like, oh, that was great. And somebody gave me a book of poems by Adrienne Rich. Mm-hmm. And some of her depictions of her relationship, I was just like, that's what I want. I want that thing. But the thing, you know, the one that like really, you know, probably, you know, sort of set me off into like being able to think about as a writer also writing queer things was Torch Song Trilogy. Mm-hmm. It just touched me in such a deep way. It's interesting. It has been revived in New York. And I saw the off-Broadway revival last year that is now the same cast as, you know, for the Broadway revival. It was very discomforting to see it at this point because some of it is still so true and powerful. But there were very wealthy straight audiences in attendance at the show that I saw laughing at, like, drag joke names. And, like, it was just a big guffaw. It was, like, so much fun. And there was this disconnect of like, what's the edge here, and what's gone. Mm. So, but still, to read the text of that,
There aren't still a whole lot of trans fiction written by trans authors, as I'm sure most people know. And so, not to at all really dump on cis authors that try to tackle those topics, I think it's great when people try very, very hard to educate people and everything in YA or what have you, but at the same time, you can still tell that it was written for a cis audience. So while they may have gotten it factually right, for lack of a better term, I did not feel seen necessarily. Mm. Like, this was like about me, but not for me. Mm. And I don't get mad about that, but it's, you know. But something very recently I just finished reading is the new memoir by Thomas Page McBee called Amateur. And it just came out in August, and it was, I think, honestly, it's so sad. It was last month of 2018 where I finally, you know, saw something that I was like, yes, mm-hmm. because he talks about, the memoir is him being in 2016, I believe, the very first trans man to box at Madison Square Garden. But the whole book is actually about how trans men struggle to navigate toxic masculinity and how we've been the victims of it this entire time. And suddenly we just get dumped into the lion's den or like, have fun, like, you know, prove that you're a man, you know, with the people that terrify you. And it was just a phenomenal memoir about that I had never seen written before. So go check that book out.
I'm going to mention three. My high school English teacher was a former nun, and I remember getting into such a fight with her because I had read Gore Vidal's Myra Breckinridge.
Oh, wow.
And I wanted to do all my papers on that book. And I didn't understand why, but I thought it was great. It was playing with gender so much. And that was a lot of fights. But that book, Giovanni's Room, by James Baldwin, which, you know, when I picked it up, I had no idea what it was about. And then there's me, the little queer, Rania, going, oh my God, somebody wrote about this. And then lastly, I'll mention a little book that I discovered in college, and I feel like I still hold right here, which is Sylvia Brownrigg, a novel called Pages for You, mm-hmm. Which is just this sweet love story between two women. And imagine my, you know, so that came out, I think, when I was in college, and I didn't mention it to anyone for years, and then slowly over years later started giving it to friends who were like having a hard time and just needed to read this lovely love story and be enveloped by it. And it felt like this private, quiet little thing. And then I was at the Austin Book Festival cocktail party after the festival last year, and a couple of people who were in the room, friends who were in the room, were with me when I spotted Sylvia Brownrigg across the room. Here promoting the sequel that came out.
Uh-huh.
And it took me two cocktails, I think, but I got up the courage to walk up to her and just melt down, like just have a total fan meltdown. You were with me.
I was there. It was beautiful. We were in the background going, do it. I lied. We don't have time for one more question, but you have plenty of time to go to the signing room. There are book sales and signings in the Gordon Room, first floor, feel free to ask your questions there. And of course, if we want to see more queer books in the world, we need to purchase the queer book. So I'm judging you. I'm watching. But please, oh, one last thing. I forgot about this very important part that they trained me to do like 5 times and I forgot. So please stay in your seats while the authors leave the room, because we need to get out first and make sure we're downstairs. So if you don't mind just staying seated for before we leave. But before we do, please give a round of applause for our amazing authors. And thanks to all of you for coming out.